You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Pamela Redmond, and you are listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show, yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Pamela Redmond. She's the author of the novel Younger, which was turned into a 7-season hit Netflix TV show by Darren Star. She's the creator of Nameberry, the world's largest baby naming website based on her 10 groundbreaking books on names. Pitching an AI service for her site, Redmond was also the oldest female contestant ever on Shark Tank. And not to be outdone with all of that, Redmond recently performed her first solo show, Old Woman Naked. Pamela, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me here.
How'd you like that bio read? Was that a good one?
It's amazing.
I couldn't not read that. That's just like so much good fun. I didn't know you had a novel that was adapted to a Netflix show. What's that like?
Well, it was pretty amazing because I wrote the novel 20 years ago, and it was optioned a lot, which I always expected it would be. I mean, it's very high concept, Younger. It's the story of a woman in her 40s who's trying to go back to work after raising her only child, and no one will hire her because she's been out of it for too long. So it wasn't my story, but a lot of my friends were in that position. And I always knew, like, this is something that a lot of people are going to want to make into a TV show. That is what I believed anyway.
Now, were you thinking that as you were writing the book, or was like the book starting to come together in a way and you were like, ooh, this might be more than a book. I can see this going.
As soon as I had the idea, I knew it.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it was, it's very high concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was a great part for an actress over 40 who got to like look hot but act soulful, you know. It was sort of, so I knew that that was a plus. Not like I knew anything about Hollywood, especially at that point, but, and it did get optioned a lot. It got optioned like 10 times by a lot of big places, but nobody ever made it. And then it was like 10 years later that Darren Star optioned it.
Hmm.
So that was really, you know, by the time he optioned it, I kind of felt like, yeah, whatever, you know,
right.
I just didn't believe it would happen. And then it did. So that was pretty amazing.
And when you find out that it's getting produced, and then at that point you're like, oh, cool, I can't wait to watch the series. do they kind of keep you in the loop a little bit where you get to go to early screenings of episodes, or do you wait until it's on Netflix to see the first episodes?
Well, there are a couple of funny stories about that. One is, I don't know if you have a Google alert set for your name, but I do.
Yeah, oh, I do. And it just, and there's like, and I'm refreshing it like a lot these days and nothing happens. Yeah, but go ahead.
Well, at the time I was living on the East Coast, and I was in upstate New York at a friend's house writing another book, which I never published, by the way. And it was the day I finished the other book, and she didn't really have internet in this house at that time. But so I looked on my phone, and there's a Google alert for my name saying it was page 6 of the New York Post saying Darren Star is making a television show of Pamela Redmond's. And I'm like, what? Nobody told me.
Yeah.
Nobody, not the agents, not anybody. So that was big news. And then
did the agents even know at that time?
Did the agent what?
Did the agent, did like your literary agent know that had happened? Like, I don't think people understand how out of the loop a lot of us are in these situations where it's just like stuff happens and we do find out on silly things by putting a notification of our name in Google News.
I know, that was incredible. Yeah, they knew, but I think it was like August, they had gone on vacation.
Yeah.
You know? So there was that. And then it was kind of, you know, moving forward. And then the night before they were going to start filming, I got an email, I guess, from Darren Star's assistant saying, oh, we're going to start filming tomorrow morning. Do you want to come to the shoot? And it
Cool.
was, I know. And at the time I lived in New Jersey and they were shooting on Long Island and it was like 7 in the morning, something like ridiculous.
Yeah.
No problem. It was a 2.5 hour drive. And I got there and it turned out my neighbor in New Jersey was the director of photography, the cinematographer for the show. Very unprepossessing guy, my age. I was friendly with his wife. So that was kind of an amazing connection. And he set me up in the booth with the headphones and everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, Darren was very nice. I mean, he's kind of a famously nice person and he was very nice to me. So that was great. There was a big party in New York and when it premiered and I did get invited to that and he gave me a shout out from the stage for these peak moments, you know?
Yeah. Isn't it? And it's in those peak moments, you're going, yeah, okay, this is the peak moment.
Yeah. I think, you know, when you want to be a writer, when you're dreaming of being a writer, you're dreaming of those moments, but the reality is, you know, you're spending like 3 years by yourself, you know, in a dark room.
Yeah.
Rewriting over and over, like trying to make your advance last till the next meal, basically. And then, you know, it's great. I mean, I remember that first day of shooting. It was kind of like, it was surreal because mm-hmm. there are 100 people in this room, you know, bringing to life a scene that I wrote. But, you know, it's over like that. That's the end.
So. Right. Yeah, and it's not as sexy because it's like, all right, cut. Now we got to turn it around and do it again. All right, cut. Now you're just sitting there going, wow, these are long days. And then you start to worry more about, well, do they got good craft services here? it's like people I know who are like in the business a lot more than I am. It's all about what craft services is. It's like, that's the talk. It's just like, oh no, on that set we had this, this, and this, and I'm just like,
I never got that, Janet.
you didn't go. You didn't get. They fed you though that day.
Oh yeah, they fed me. But yeah. I didn't go to the set that often. I went, you know, 3 or 4 times maybe. So.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah.
And plus, you don't have to sit there and deal with the personalities of ego that always happen on these things.
So. Yeah. Well, Sutton Foster, also famously nice person. And so she was always very nice to me and made me feel welcome. And, you know.
And essentially, she's the one that played the lead?
Yes, she played the lead. So which was an amazing, I mean, I was like a Broadway fan. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard that that was who was playing the lead, I was just blown away because she really was 40, you know, she really was in her 40s.
Yeah.
I was afraid they were going to hire like Hilary Duff, you know, who played the young best friend. But I was afraid that this was before I knew Darren Star, but that he would hire Hilary Duff, who was 30 or whatever, to pretend to be 40, pretending to be 30.
Yeah.
But no, he hired someone who really was. So that was cool.
Oh, thanks for answering that question. Because I had that in the back of my mind of was the actress over 40. Because it's so fascinating when I see these, when I see some of these shows, and it'll be like a mother and daughter like talking. And I'm like, I know the mom part. I know that woman is only 8 years older than the actress playing the daughter. It's just like daughter's playing younger than she is. The mother's playing older than she is. And they're probably more like sister age.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more egregious with, mother and son. I think the famous one was Sally Field and Tom Hanks and Forrest Gump.
Oh my God. Wow.
With only a handful of years older than him. But then of course, you know, you flip it around and it's like the guy who's 28 years older is like the boyfriend, like the hot boyfriend of the 25-year-old actress, which like give me a break.
Right. What's an example of that? Because my mind went blank and I'm trying to figure out one.
Of the older guy and
the
woman. Mm. I just saw one the other night and I'm not remembering it now, but it was.
See, they're completely forgettable because of that.
Yeah.
It ruins the story.
It ruins the story. Yeah.
That's fun. And then you're the creator of Nameberry. So backstory to the listeners here. I met Pamela about a week or so ago, and we were just chatting, and Pamela was talking about her amazing solo show, which we'll get to in a little bit, called Old Woman Naked. And then I'm like, oh my God, I need to have her on the podcast. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh wait, oh my God. This is like, who did I find? What is this gold mine of past?
Oh, that's so sweet.
Yeah.
Thank you. So
name Barry. Hello, creator.
Yeah. Well, my partner Linda Rosenkrantz and I wrote 10 books about names starting in the 80s. So mm-hmm. we owned all of our rights. And the books were, you know, it was a childhood passion of mine and of Linda's. We were just friends who both loved names.
Yeah.
So these books really were, you know, the first one was called Beyond Jennifer and Jason, and they really changed the culture around names and naming. And, you know, we were the first people to make lists of names. We were the first people to make a list of popular names, the first people to make a list of celebrity baby names, you know, things uh-huh. that become so endemic. And the book sold, you know, a couple of million copies.
My God, look at you out the gate.
Books were huge. And then I think we started licensing them. You know, we started licensing them to other, like Time Warner and stuff. And then a neighbor of mine, another neighbor in New Jersey who was a VC, said, like, your business model is all wrong. You have to build a website. So Linda is 20 years older than me. You know, I'm already old. Everyone knows how old I am. I'm 73. Linda is 20 years older than me. She's like, I don't want it. This is 20 years. I don't want to start a website. I said, I'll do it. You know, we have to do it.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. And yeah, we just launched, and I bought out Linda a few years ago, but we just launched an app actually. So I'm in the, besides being the world's oldest stripper, I'm in the world of baby naming apps, which is like seems very disparate, but you know, the unifying principle is identity.
And it's interesting that using the names like Jason and Jennifer in the 1980s, mm-hmm. Jennifer was such a popular name for so long. I don't think people are calling their kids Jennifer now. Yeah. Is there, like, Jennifer is not a name. It's almost like it'd be cool if you named your kid Jennifer now, because 20 years from now, that's going to be the, the Evangelique, you know, it'll be like, what is your name? Jennifer? Who's called Jennifer? It's so exotic.
Well, we have a 100-year rule. It takes 100 years for a name to come back. So
is that true?
For a lot of names, yeah. It's like you don't want to give your kid your parents' names. You know, mm-hmm. you don't want to give them the names of your friends, not your parents' names, not even your grandparents' names. Like, I'm grandma age now. Nobody's naming their kid Pam. You know, they're not. The Jennifers aren't naming their kids Pam.
Yeah.
My mother's name was Margaret. Yeah, maybe Margaret's okay. And she was born in the 20s. That makes sense.
Right. And you just reminded me. The first woman I asked to marry me when I was 6 years old, her name was Pam, and I never broke it off with her, so we might still be engaged. So, and I am a man who fulfills my commitment, so Pam, if you're listening. but it's like, it's interesting because when I was like a young kid, I wanted to be I remember I was just like, oh, why am I a Tony? I want to be a Jim or a James. And I grew up in a religion, so I had a Bible. So I would actually write my name Jim Duchesne in it, because I just really wanted to. It's just like Tony didn't fit in anywhere because I didn't know any other Tonys at school or anything like that. And then it was just like but growing into a Tony, it was like, oh yeah, because the family background's got Italian, and they would call mm-hmm. me Tonio, and it's just so it's really fascinating how the name, how our names stick with us even though it's a choice of our parents, you know. It's like we don't have any, and it's kind of good we don't have any skin in the game in naming ourselves, because I'd be Jim Duchesne right now, and I don't want to be a Jim. No, you know what? I am Tony.
Well, kids today, I mean, young, like 13-year-olds or whatever, are renaming themselves. It's a trend.
Oh, they gotta stop. Just stop it, kids. Can you go like skateboard and get some broken bones, please? Worry about something else.
Tony's an interesting name, though, because it's kind of in the US, I think, because a lot of Italian immigrants are called Tony, right? And so it has this kind of working class. But
Yeah.
in England, it's like Anthony is a very upper class, Tony is a very upper class name. Like Princess Margaret's husband was Tony, right? Tony.
Oh, I didn't know. I got to go to England and be upper class.
Yeah, you would be. It has a
Yeah.
very different image. It's completely
Huh.
different. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there was also a lot of I mean, especially with the Italian Americans, a lot of keep the Italian identity down a little bit, you know. It's just like, yeah, you're not Italian, you know. We got slurs for that. So, yeah, it's, maybe I'm lucky I got the Anthony with these yeah. Anyway, I lost my train of thought there. Thinking of my great grandparents. God bless their souls.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, names were always kind of the way Nameberry, the website we built, is still the world's biggest baby naming website. And for many years, that was what paid the bills. I mean, God knows, by
Wow.
examples, even if you have one adapted for TV,
Yeah.
doesn't pay the bills.
Right.
But then AI stole all of our content before we even knew they existed.
That's okay. And that's why we were talking about AI at that party. And
Yes.
that's why we were talking about old woman naked. And
That's
that's why you had a lot of very opinionated, and not in a bad way, because it's just like, hey, what do you think of AI? And you were like, oh, and you were like throwing down. It was like if you were if you were playing a hockey game, gloves would have hit the ice. And I was like, wow, she's pretty passionate about that. Now I understand why. So, but I kind of led too far of a question to you because now the listeners are like, what is he talking about? So when I'm out, let's just back up and pretend like that wasn't any foreshadowing there for you listening in the audience. Pamela, so you're in this solo show called Old Woman Naked. Tell me how that came about.
Okay. So I was feeling extremely frustrated about the website that I have, and 40 years worth of work, original, very original work, had been wholesale stolen by AI.
What? AI? Oh my God, this is what's happening with AI.
Well, yeah. I mean, where do you think they're getting all their knowledge?
Yeah.
They're not making it up. So we have a counter on our website that shows how many robots scrape our site every week. It's about 2 million a week.
Wow.
From all, from Meta, from Google, from Grok, from, ChatGPT, Claude. I mean, there's so, China, there's so many companies. So it was like by the time we realized this was happening, it was done. And then China DeepSeek came along and stole everything from them. So it's like the barn door is like not only open, it's like been blasted off its hinges.
Yeah,
So there's
yeah.
no getting that back. And it was, horrible. And I just felt like I need to, and as I talked about before, AI can also write novels. I mean, it can. And it they're not that bad. We want to believe they're bad, but they're not as bad as you want them to be.
So
Not
you've read a novel written by AI?
I've written a novel written by AI. I mean, I've had AI write a novel.
Okay,
Yeah.
and I it's do you I feel like there is there's a beauty of imperfection and also a beauty of our single point of view that separates us from the collective AI point of view to write a correct novel. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe AI knows how to make itself feel, show itself a little flawed. Is that the case?
Well, it sure knows how to show itself as anything you want it to show itself as. I
Okay.
mean, that's really the genius of it. is that it can impersonate any psychology or any viewpoint you want it to, but it's not original. It can't create something original. So if you go to AI, like if I went to AI today and I had that idea for the novel that became Younger, and I said, all right, I want to write a book about a mom who has been home for 15 years raising her kid, and she's ready to go back. Her kid's in, you know, it's the setup. It's what you need to start writing a novel. Her kid's in away on junior year abroad, and she's ready to go back to work. And she really, you know, all her contacts are gone. Her knowledge of, you know, media technology is past, and no one wants to hire her. And she, you know, gets a young boyfriend. She gets a young best friend who thinks she's really young. They both think she's really young. And she has an older friend who she lives with. All right. That's the setup of the show. It's the setup of the book. I thought of all that stuff before I started writing, as one would. You know, that was my original idea. But I had all those ideas in the first, you know, few days or whatever. You know, if you fed that into AI, I'm sure it could write a book as good as Younger. Because Younger wasn't, you know, it was a good book, but it was mostly a high concept story. And it was, you know, it wasn't like a novelist I love is Sally Rooney, you know. I mean, it's not Sally Rooney. It's not, you know, I reread Great Gatsby recently and was just like blown away. Like, oh my God, what I felt like was he turned on the lights in the world. That's what I felt like.
Wow.
Like, every sentence was like, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
It's not that, but neither am I. You know, I can't write that well either. So I try. I could have an original idea and, you know, develop it in an original way. But in any case, so I was just feeling very frustrated about, like, that AI was basically eating my lunch, that it was, you know, everything that I had spent a 50-year career doing with, you know, it's really hard to be a writer and it's really hard to make a living in these businesses and to do everything I've done and you've done and, you know, all the writers who are listening have done. And it came in, it was like doing everything I knew how to do. Like, what could I do that it absolutely positively could not do? That was the challenge I set myself, you know. It was like, it had to be live.
Yeah.
Be personal, it had to be true, it had to be real, and it had to be about my body, because our bodies are the only thing that AI doesn't have. AI does not have a body. So that idea, it was kind of like the idea for Younger, like it just was boom, it just came. And
so did you have this specific idea of Old Woman Naked, or were there a couple of other ideas that you were bouncing around?
No, it was just this idea.
Just this one. Man, you know, I feel like you're really good at getting that idea, and then the execution part is, you just go for it.
Well, yes, but, you know, I have a lot of other ideas, too, that are not as good. But this one, I knew, you know, like, and Younger, and also the name stuff, I knew from the beginning, and you probably feel this way too, when it's a really good idea, you know, like,
yeah.
And usually when I get what I think is a really good idea, I deliberately don't write it down because I want to see if it sticks with me, you know, because if I'm going to spend 2 or 3 years on something, I want to be interested enough that it's not going to, you know, I'm not going to forget it tomorrow. But that one, I would just like, I have to do this right now. And I just wrote the first draft very quickly, like in a few days, I think. And
don't you love the urgency of that when you know, and you're just like, I got, this is the time is now.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating because it's like, how does our collective conscious and the universe all come together where it zones in on us as individuals and goes, this one's for you? Because ideas are out there for the grabbing, and it's just like, you know, but this is like, there's many ideas, but you are the one that will execute this idea from front to back, from beginning to end. Best of luck, because a lot of times it's going to hurt and take a lot of work.
Yes. And I've tried to give some of them away too, sometimes successfully.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's not very often. And plus, it was great because it wasn't, a novel is like takes a really long time to write. And so it was like, oh, you could write, I think the first draft was 10 pages or 12 pages. It was like
And
very long.
you're talking about the monologue essentially for the one woman show is
Yeah.
have you like done other stage productions or anything like
Never,
that? This was your
never.
first time attempting anything on stage and you come up with a monologue of 10 pages.
Yes.
Wow.
And my first time ever performing anything.
Wow.
So
You
the
know,
idea.
that's like, can we just have a moment of silence for that and just really
Oh, you're so
realize
sweet.
how important that is? You're 73 years old, you have an idea, you have a bold idea, and you do it. And I feel like I have students come through my classes and they're like, "Oh my God, I'm 30, like life is over." And I'm like, "You cute little thing, you have no clue." Because the beauty of it, I think society kind of puts this thing where it's just like, "Oh no, that doesn't make sense." Especially when we're talking about entertainment business, just like as we were discussing earlier, where they would cast, a 35-year-old to play a 40-year-old or whatever. There's a lot of weird age stuff going on out there. People don't realize that we are hungry for authenticity, honesty, and truth. And I think that transcends age and that transcends it all. And when you're honest and true, doesn't matter your age, how young you are, how old you are, you go for it. You go for it at 93. I mean, it's just, don't let it end. Don't let it end.
Well, the more you do it, the more you want to do it, because the
Yeah.
experience for me has been so I didn't realize when I started writing the story of my body. I didn't realize that I was really writing the story of my secrets. So my secret story. So it's like I didn't realize this till, like basically last week until I'd already performed the show. I'm like, oh my God, like all these stories I tell in the show, it's like, throughout my life, they're all things that I've never told anybody. And they all my secrets are related to my body, throughout my life. Those are the things that I felt like I couldn't say. So there I am standing on stage telling all these secrets and taking off my clothes as I tell the secrets. So it's a revelation on two levels, and a very powerful experience for me. And I'm getting that back from the audience who is, relating it to their own lives and their own secrets, because it turns out we all have been keeping the same secrets, at least women, but a lot of men too.
The secrets are universal. I think as writers, we expose ourselves more. I remember when my first book came out, and people who I knew and who knew me growing up, and they were just like, "I could never have written what you wrote, but like, wow, thank you for writing that because I feel the same way or I had the same experience." And it's sad that people. It takes a lot in order to just expose ourselves and expose those shameful ideas or shameful thoughts or even shameful actions. And it really is a beautiful thing to be open about it because we all have it. And we can't we got what the purity thing of mind and soul is like that's fake. It's just like the answer to that is no. We're all we all have our shadow, and it's just the beauty of ex of acts, you know. And I'm still excavating the, things where I'm just like, wait, I'm what? Oh my! Oh okay. I don't want to tell anyone that right now, but maybe one of my characters in a novel could be that terrible person with that terrible idea, but it's actually me.
Well, you know, I'm a novelist. I've been hiding this stuff, you know, burying this stuff within. And in fact, I in the show, I read from a novel that I wrote that was heavily autobiographical when I was young. It was my first novel, and I
Well,
was
what was
so
that called?
well.
Oh, that sounds like a trick question.
Well, I, you know, it actually the one thing it doesn't have that's good, it doesn't have a great title, but the story of this novel is that it was the story of my first, like, crazy first boyfriend who I married, okay? And when I wrote the book 20 years after the relationship, but I was still too afraid to publish it. So I hid it, and I hid it so well that I lost it for 35 years.
Wow.
So it wasn't until like a year ago, or maybe 2 years ago, when there was that very rainy winter, that I like really emptied every box, and I couldn't believe there was the book,
Yeah.
and all the things that I had disguised, the real things that I had disguised, came back to me through the novel. But in the show, I tell the real story, but I also read pieces of the novel. Like, this is how I fictionalized this.
Yeah.
So I don't know, you know, that might be something that you or the listeners who know about writing might relate to. I'm not sure that it totally translates for people watching the show, but it's interesting for me because it's what I did with all these secrets to try not to tell them over all these years, right?
Right. And I don't, do you really think it's trying not to tell them, or do you think it's us accessing them in a certain way to maybe admit, and hopefully we have connection with our reader, and then so it's not like an active, I'm not trying to say this out loud. It's more of a, this is feeding this character, this is feeding this arc of the story. I'm fortunate that I have these various attributes to myself that I can put into the characters because I know these attributes, and they could be the archetype of this person, or this version of me, and the archetype of this version of me. I
Yeah, I
wonder.
mean, I think you're exactly right, but I think that I did not realize how much I was doing that as a novelist until I did a lot of hypnotherapy over the past few years.
Oh, it's so good. I've done hypnotherapy. It's like helped me a lot.
Me too.
Yeah.
Very helpful creatively, you know, and getting in touch with. And I was writing this book that I still am not finished with called The Matriarch. And I would talk to the hypnotherapist about the matriarch. And I would talk about my character and say, well, she feels blah, blah, blah. And he would say, you feel. He kept bringing it back to me. You feel. And it really was the first time that I realized how directly the character was related to me, and what I was having her do, you know, disguising it, but obviously not very well.
Were you scared at any point when your hypnotherapist is pointing those things out to you that you'll lose the creativity because you'll be too in touch with yourself?
No. He really, I mean, I definitely credit him directly for the idea with for this play, you know, because he last summer said something to me like, I said, well, I have to decide what to do next. Do I want to do a big prod, you know? And he's like, don't put your ideas in a box, you know, you don't just let your creativity flow over all these different things. Don't, you know, it doesn't have to be a book or a blah or a blah, you know, a newsletter, whatever you're doing, just let it come out however it's going to come out. I know that sounds really artsy fartsy or whatever.
It's it, but it's not. I mean, yeah, it may sound that way, but I think there's a deepness to it that it's just like, yeah, it's so simple, it's complex, or it's, you know what I'm saying?
Yes, and I think that, you know, going back to the idea of identity being this unifying idea behind all this work that sounds so disconnected, and identity being at the center of all that, I think that allowed me to take things I've been writing about fictionally and write something this personal, which I'd never written anything like close to this personal ever. So.
So you're working on a monologue to present on stage as for the first time, and you got your first draft. How do you attack rewriting it? Are you rewriting it like with your novel brain in mind, or are you really encompassing? Going, wait a second. Even though have you acted before or no? This is your first acting.
No, never.
So your first acting gig, you get it at 73, and so keep hope alive, people. But but you got so this is your first acting gig. How are you approaching putting the script together for your first acting gig? Is in the rewrites, are you just trying to, like, how do you do punch-ups on that? Because it's not a novel. This is something that's going to be spoken and has to engage an audience from an oral point of view.
Yeah, good point. You know, my best friend, I got divorced after 33 years and moved to LA 10 years ago. So I was 61, or, you know, I guess it was more than 10, 11, 12 years ago. I was 61, newly arrived in the city, you know, no friends. And in a writing class, I met a woman who had recently lost her job at Disney. She was a creative chief of ABC Family. And we were both, you know, women of a certain age who'd had these big lives that suddenly were gone. And so we were at liberty. We were, you know, we were looking for friends. We were looking for interesting things to do. So we just became friends over time. And when I wrote Old Woman Naked, she, and I really trust her taste. You know, she was the executive who did Gilmore Girls and Pretty Little Liars, Buffy, you know, a lot of iconic shows. And I just really love her. You know, I think her taste is amazing. So she liked this idea from the beginning and read a lot of drafts of it. But I said, I want you to produce this show in LA, even though she had never produced theater. I just knew that I would like working with her and that she would do a great job. So that's been super interesting. She's done an amazing job. She's brought in all these TV refugees who have, you know, the TV producers who've been to the show. It's just like a mind-blowing array of people, which has been very fun. So actually last weekend I had all these ideas for rewriting it, and I just let myself do whatever I feel like doing. That's what you have to do if you're creative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, I'm like, all right, I need to read this for you now, but only for you, because I trust her opinion. And she basically didn't like, you know, 85% of it.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't like it, I'm like, you're right. I very happily will let it go. So
I feel like also at the same time, the stuff that we've written and we have to let go is part of the process. Like yes, 85% of that draft was cut, but we need to write the stuff that's cut to get to the thing that's going to make it into either the thing we're working on or sometimes another piece that we work on down the road.
Yeah, totally. There's a director in New York named Wendy C. Goldberg, sent the script to her, and she really liked it. And she wants to develop it for a celebrity to star in. Mm. So I've been working with her as well. Where was I going with this? She said what she wants to do at this point is to hire an actor to just do a closed reading.
Yeah.
She's like, I think you need to sit back and hear this.
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm really interested to do that because.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So yeah. I think I'm going to be doing that.
Well, if you need a plus one to that closed reading, I would be I would love to be a fly on a wall. Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be very cool.
Yeah. I just love the process part. Even when friends have like, when they're screenplay, they're like, oh, we're doing a table read. I'm like, I'm in. What do you need? Narrator. That's it. Got it. Good. Just to be around those juices and just to actually even see the screenwriter like finally realize that, oh, wait. I mean, when you do that table read, that's just like, you go, oh, crap. Oh, man. Okay. You're just like redlining like so much because it's about really hearing it after you get to that point, you know?
Also, you know, especially I did it once in New York, right? And when I did it in New York, it was kind of a dinner theater thing and I could see everybody in the audience. In LA, the theater I've been doing it at is a regular theater, very vertical, and it's very dark. So I can only see a few people in the front row. So my only cue to how people are reacting is if they laugh.
Yeah.
And it's funny in a lot of places, you know, I love the laugh. But there's a real, you know, dark period in the middle. Mm-hmm. And when I get to that, I don't know. I'm like, is it boring? Or, you know, if people aren't laughing or sobbing, I guess, it looks like, is it boring? Are they horrified? Are they? So I would like to be able to judge that. And afterward, people tell me like, no, I was just feeling very moved, you know, but I would like to experience that for myself and you know, judge, like, was it boring? I'm always afraid of being boring, you know?
And those are very vulnerable spots to be in when you've been performing this, maybe in the very early performance stages. Did you find yourself kind of speeding up when you were hitting that? Because you're just like, wait a second, this is getting too vulnerable because I can't tell what everyone's looking at. And so did your cadence go up a little bit?
That you must do these. Do you do monologues? Because
I have in the past. Yeah.
Because I never have, and I didn't know this, but it's funny because I just went to the hairdresser, and my hairdresser went to the show and loved the show. And he said to me this morning, like, I love the show, it was so great, blah, blah, blah. I have one note. He's like, at the end, and this is like when I am finally fully naked, there are like two paragraphs that I read, and it's, you know, it's hopefully very moving. I usually burst into tears at the end. It's very emotional. He's like, you got to slow down.
Yeah.
And my friend Kate, who's the producer, she says the same thing, you know, and one version of the script, like every three paragraphs, there's a note that just says, take a breath.
Yeah.
I'm getting bored and I want to, you know, I've heard this too many times.
Right. And you have to continue to make it the first time fresh for yourself as the actor who's in a play, essentially. So you doing a standalone monologue, do you try to get into a space where it's just like, wait, how do I make this fresh for me tonight? Because I know there's people that are coming in for their first experience on it, which is so different than being a writer. We just throw the stuff out there and then they can have their experiences for decades. But when you're like, okay, I'm going up for show number 20 and I got to pretend like this is fresh, new, comedic, tragic, take them through the whole thing.
How do you do that? Because
I don't know. Yeah. It's
I don't know.
I mean, I did some stand-up comedy like over 20 years ago and I had maybe a good 10-minute set, but I learned so much working on that for a long time and getting booked. You know, I was getting booked for showcase stuff and getting paid. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, this is when I lived in San Francisco. And I just feel like that, even though I didn't choose that, I went, no, I'm writing. Because one of the things was I didn't care about comedy audiences and I still kind of don't care. I love the craft of comedy. Mm-hmm. I kind of hate going to see comedy because I'm like, you guys need this person to, like, you know, you don't know how to make these jokes yourself and figure it out. And it's probably something I need to get over. It's probably another flaw of my, you know, I'd just rather have a conversation with someone. Like, you know, doing this with you right now is so much more entertaining to me than going to see Dave Chappelle at, what's the big one here? Comedy Store, because I think he just performed there with but it's just like that doesn't interest me. This interests me more than that.
I would agree. I mean, someone that I, because I've been watching a lot of these shows, you know, just to see what's out there. And the person I really love is Mike Birbiglia.
Yeah,
because I think he really finds some ground that is really, you know, personal, and it's a story, but it's also funny, and it's not all funny. You know, I think he's more of a comedian than I am, but I've also seen amazing solo shows here. I think I saw one at the Geffen called maybe I Am Roxy, something like that. That was very theatrical. You know, she did so much physical, and it was about her mother having Alzheimer's. Not a funny topic, but you know, she was like rolling over and just doing all this. It's like that's not going to happen with me, but. So I like that middle space. You know, I'm definitely not a stand-up, but I'm not that theatrical performer either.
Yeah, and it's and I like I love the solo monologue shows. I mean, oh my God, Spalding Gray. I don't know if you ever saw
Oh
him.
my God,
Like,
love him.
I got to see him a few times when I was younger, and it's just like he could just like he could take you in for 90 minutes. You don't even know 90 minutes went by, and it's just him, and it's
Yeah.
just like, how does he do this?
I know. You know, I was such a big fan of his that I wrote him a fan letter. He actually called me up and left, but you know, this was the days of answering machines. He left a voicemail, you know, on my machine
Yeah,
that just
on the
went.
little mini recording cassette.
Yeah. And it went on for so long that the tape ran out. But he didn't leave his number. I never tried. And he died like not that soon after that, which was so heartbreaking and
It was
horrible.
so tragic that, yeah, I did.
Yeah. Thanks for reminding me of him. Like that really makes me, I want to see him again because I don't know. Are his shows on anything, you know, streaming at all?
Well, I know Swimming to Cambodia, I think that was directed by Soderbergh, if I remember
Oh,
right. So
really?
they made a film out of that.
Yeah.
But did you keep the tape? Like, do you have the audio
I
still?
did for a long time and then I lost it, you know, like my novel. I mean, when I moved here, I left. I mean, it's amazing that the novel made it because I just left everything behind. So.
Well, I know what going through a divorce is like, and it's just like, yeah, it's at some point you're just like, possessions, I'm just trying to bring sanity with me. I'm trying to bring Look, I'm just trying to carry sanity on this airplane. I don't even know what I have or don't have, and at some point it's just like, it doesn't matter. Let it burn.
Right. It's a very heavy load, just as it is, you know.
Yeah. How do you memorize your monologue, or do you read some of it, or do you read all of it?
No, I don't. You know, when I did it in New York, I did not attempt to memorize it. But when I did it here, I just decided I have to memorize it. It just felt unprofessional to me not to. So I don't know. I don't have any trips. I have a lot of trips, no tricks. just, you know, saying it again and again and again. Sometimes, like one reason I rewrote it last weekend was because there were certain lines that I forgot every time, and I just decided those need a better setup or a better lead in or something, you know, better reason for being that so I will remember them. You know, I have little tricks about some things. There's this thing I say, and this is not original enough to give it away, but it's talking about how much happier I got as I got older. And it says, the more invisible I became to the world, the more clearly I could see myself. The more vulnerable I la allowed myself to be, the stronger I felt. And the older I got, the happier I was. So I remember that. I had trouble remembering that, but I remember that by I drew an eye, an arm, and a smile. Yeah. But you know, when I was on Shark Tank, I had to remember like that little presentation you do at the beginning. It's like 90 seconds or like it took me a month to learn that. I could not, that was really hard. So
So you had monologue experience on network TV.
well,
Wait a second. Now Wait,
yes.
how do you work with a producer? I mean, because are you like, are you doing blocking with them? Are you also, because, and if the listeners are listening, you do strip down completely naked to the end of the show to show the truth of your body as well as the truth of all your shame. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Is there tweaks on to when to take certain clothes off? Is there different cues? How does a producer work with you on that?
Well, we actually had a director here in LA, and that was something Kate, my producer, insisted on. I kind of felt like, I don't need a producer, you know, I'll just say my lines.
Mm-hmm.
Director. So Jennifer Chambers was her name. She had directed POTUS at the Geffen, which I thought was a wonderful show. So she really helped me, like, you know, figure out when to move. There were certain cues. There's like, there's a cue where I say something about taking off my bra, and that's obviously taking off my bra. So I tried to, you know, build those in also, take off certain things at certain moments. And I start out wearing more clothes than a person would normally wear. So I would have a lot to take off.
Yeah, if I ever do strip poker in my life, I'm going to show up like in, you know, overcoats and everything. And they'll be like, dude, we're in the desert. It's like 110. I'm like, yeah, but I got a lot of shame, man. So, and I'm not good at poker. So let's go.
Taking the clothes off, everyone's like, aren't you nervous? I'm not nervous with the clothes. I'm much more nervous about forgetting my lines.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, have you ever performed naked before, or is this your first time? That's a serious question.
No, I have not. But, you know, one of the first stories I tell in the show was about my first father-in-law taking me and my husband, we were both teenagers, to a strip club. And I thought it was going to be, I thought he was taking us out for dinner, which was a very big deal. And indeed, there was food involved. But we're in this strip club, and he says, you ought to do that, Pam. Get up there and strip. They're having amateurs night. You'd make a lot of money. I'd come see you. I know.
Yeah, that's quite inappropriate.
Well, you know, it was the 70s, so people said things like that all the time. Like, your boss would say something like that to you.
Right, but a father-in-law wanting to suggest that you get on a pole and take it all off for him. That's
horrifying. Yeah. But no, but I did not take his advice at that time.
What, so you were a teenager when you got married? Is that what I just heard?
I was 19, yeah.
You were 19. And how old was your husband?
19 also.
How did you guys meet, and why did you get married so young?
Well, you're gonna have to see the show to really hear that story.
Okay, we don't want any spoilers, but that's good. That's a teaser. And so the divorce you had at 61, that was your second husband?
Yes, that was okay. That was not 19 to 61, I think.
Right. No, I was doing the math in my head, and I was like, well, if you just subtract 35 from the 7, carry the 1, do the square root of 19. So.
Yeah. No, that was the second husband.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. And it's just, I just really like the angle on this. I know there's plans to do more shows, and you were talking about New York, and I don't want to put any words in your mouth, but you were talking about New York, and if you play New York, and I hope I'm traveling through New York so I'm there to see the gig.
Yeah, the big decision at this point is, do I keep doing it, or do we really develop an actress?
And yes.
If someone famous and amazing stepped forward and wanted to do it, of course, that would be the dream. And it would, today at the hairdresser's, I totally by chance, and he doesn't know this, but was sitting next to Frances McDormand's publicist.
Oh, okay.
And Frances McDormand, I asked Kate, my producer, yesterday, who's your dream person?
She's yes.
like, McDormand. I'm like, she would be so fabulous. And I thought, you know, when you said the universe sent you these things, it's like, there's the exterminator. Exterminator. So I thought the universe sent me Frances McDormand's publicist. So, and the hairdresser had seen my show and was telling him about the show. So maybe he'll tell Frances McDormand, and maybe she'll be listening to this podcast. And
yeah, she listens all the time. She calls me and gives me notes.
Good job, Tommy.
I was going to ask you who would be your dream person, but after you say that, I'm like, that would be my dream person too. Not only is it the dream person, it's like, oh no, that's the person. Do you feel that way? Where that name comes to your head and the image of her comes to your mind, and you're just like, I don't think anybody else can pull it off.
Well, I think some other people can. I mean, Jessica.
A very good thing to say, because they may get cast.
I mean, Jessica Lange would be amazing. And my shorthand has always been Jessica Lange on Broadway. But I kind of think Jessica Lange was married to Sam Shepard and Mikhail Baryshnikov. I think she's got better stories than I do.
You never know. They may come down to the dirty souls of novelists who kind of just made it here and there. You know, that might intrigue them more than their lives.
Maybe, you know, they can be open without, maybe it's like being a novelist, you know, they can be open without being open. I think Whoopi Goldberg would be amazing.
Oh, wow.
But Frances McDormand, I think, really inhabits this character in a way, like someone mentioned Sigourney Weaver, who of course is fantastic. It's like, I can't imagine Sigourney Weaver getting date raped. I just don't think it would happen.
Well, see, and this is where it really sucks for actors, because they do things like Alien and they're badass on the screen. And then, so we have our perceptions of them. And then it's like, we'll never be able to take out her from Alien from anything she does. Us old people who know what Alien is, you young people listening, you might not know. Check it out. Good film. But it's beautiful, because that's, it's like with my book that I'm just dying to get an agent for this book that I have now, so I can not be the dude who grew up a Jehovah's Witness and wrote a book about it, even though that's all I got right now. So you're just sitting there going, yeah, I know. It's so old news. I got failed novels, and I got this one great novel that needs to get out there.
What's your title?
Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So you're looking for, I mean, agent books suck.
Yeah, I know. No, I know. It's a rough game right now.
I just fired my agent.
Did you?
I did, because it's like, I don't know why I need one at this point. It's like, they don't do anything.
Thank you. Her first solo show is called Old Woman Naked. It's Pamela Redman. Stay tuned for that, because that's a thing. We're going to see more of this. We may see more of it with Pamela as the monologue actress, or we may see big time famous people doing it. Pamela, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Tony, thank you so much. This was lovely and hilarious.
You are listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.